they said they would. They stone you when you're trying to go home. They'll stone you when you're there all alone. But I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned.
Bob Dylan and co-conspirators on Rainy Day Women 12 and 35, the opening salvo from his 1966 masterpiece, Blonde on Blonde. I'm Bill Nye, and you're listening to Nashville Cats, The Making of Blonde on Blonde, the definitive story of what really went down on tape and in the studio during the recording of, arguably, Dylan's greatest LP.
Selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlor is filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. One hand tied to the tightrope walker, the other is in his pants. And the riot squad, they're restless. They need somewhere to go. As Lady and I look out tonight from Desolation Row.
To begin at the beginning of the Blonde on Blonde story is to backtrack a little to the August 1965 New York recording of Desolation Row, the epic final track of the Highway 61 Revisited album. Newly appointed Columbia staff producer Bob Johnston had suggested that Dylan would benefit from recording in Nashville. The Texan-born Johnston had recorded extensively there and felt instinctively that his new charge would work well in the recording centre that had dubbed itself Music City. Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, rejected the idea, but, undeterred, Johnston took the opportunity of inviting a Nashville guest, who happened to be visiting the New York World Fair, along to the Desolation Row session. Harmonica virtuoso and multi-instrumentalist Charlie McCoy recalls Johnston's clever ploy.
He had promised me Broadway tickets, and I called him, said, okay, I'm in town, how about the tickets? And he said, no problem, I have the tickets. If you're free this afternoon, I'd like you to come over. I'm recording Bob Dylan at Columbia Studio. I'd like you come over to meet him. I didn't know he had this scheme in his head to get Bob Dylan to Nashville. So I went over there, and I met him, and he said, one of the only things he ever said to me, well, I can tell you everything he ever said to me on two hands here. He said to me, hi, I'm glad to meet you. I have one of your records. And then he said, I'm going to record a song. Why don't you grab that guitar and play along? And then everything else he ever said to me was, I don't know. What do you think? The song was Desolation Row, and Bob Johnston used the experience as a way to talk him into coming down here.
Bob Johnston confirms that the tactic was the end game of his attempt to lure Dylan to Nashville.
Before I even recorded him, I got him in the console, and I was saying, I got the studio fixed up in Nashville, got great musicians. He said, like Jack Benny. He never would answer you. Just, like that. And he walked out. I think it was Charlie McCoy playing on that goddamn song that got him down there. He couldn't get it out of his head.
Johnston had sown the seed that would later flower in Nashville, but it would be a while before Bob Dylan could satisfy the country itch as a punishing tour schedule took hold.
Your pawnbroker roared. Also, so did the landlord.
In November 65, Dylan and backing band The Hawks returned to the Columbia label's New York Studio A to begin work on new material. These sessions, which continued into the new year, failed to yield takes that Dylan was satisfied with. though they came tantalizingly close, as is evidenced by some of the material later released on the officially sanctioned bootleg series.
Why'd you have to treat me so bad? Did it have to be that way? Treat you so bad. You shouldn't take it so personal. I didn't mean to make you so sad. You just happened to be there, that's all. I saw you say goodbye to your friend and smile. I thought it was well understood that you'd be coming back in a little while. I didn't know that you were saying goodbye for good. Did what you're supposed to do. Sooner or later, one of us must know that I really did try to get close to you.
The one track from this round of studio dates that did make the final cut for Blonde on Blonde was Sooner or Later, One of Us Must Know. This came about with a change of personnel and the arrival of pianist Paul Griffin and organist Al Cooper, who remembers feeling somewhat nervous about playing alongside the prodigiously talented Griffin.
It was very intimidating because Paul ended up playing what I think is in the top three of piano playing on a rock and roll track.
The track remains, for Al Cooper, a showcase for the late Paul Griffin's rare talent.
What I tell people is to put the track on and just listen to the piano for the entire time of the track. And I think it's, for other keyboard players, I think it's very educational to see his adjustment, because we're not reading or anything. We're just, you know, jamming. And that's pretty amazing playing.
Doing what you're supposed to do. Sooner or later, one of us must know that I really did try to get close to you.
Retaining the services of Al Cooper and guitarist Robbie Robertson, Dylan made the decision to decamp to Nashville, where Bob Johnston had assembled a talented group of musicians, many drawn from the lineup of local outfit Charlie McCoy and the Escorts. Escorts guitarist Wayne Moss highlights the instrumental dexterity of a band far removed from the Nashville stereotype.
Escorts was reported to be the best rock and roll band that Nashville ever had back in that day. McCoy would play bass with his left hand, trumpet with his right, and we had two saxes besides that, baritone and a tenor. And the piano player would play chords on the piano with his left hand and play trumpet with his right, so it sounded like Motown. It was six pieces.
Happy with the musicians he'd selected for the Dylan sessions, Bob Johnston opted for block booking an unlikely studio. Columbia's Nashville Studio A was newly built and regarded as something of a sterile environment. And as Charlie McCoy explains, the idea of block booking a studio was itself an innovation.
Back in those days, block booking was unheard of. Nobody, you know, blocked a studio for like that kind of time, because, you know, a country artist, you do an album in three sessions, it's done. So the idea of block booking, and it just didn't exist here. So this whole thing was new to everyone here.
Accustomed to four-hour studio sessions that would produce four completed tracks, the first afternoon date for what would become Blonde on Blonde was something of a culture shock for the local musicians Bob Johnston had recruited.
With your mercury mouth in the missionary times, and your eyes like smoke, and your prayers like rhymes.
Just how different a Bob Dylan session was when compared to a regular mid-60s Nashville date is made clear by Charlie McCoy and Wayne Moss.
It amazed me that most people would come in like with four songs with charts and everything. He would come in with one song and say, it's not finished yet, y'all take a break. So we signed a card every 3 hours and played ping pong and waited.
We were excited, but you know, we didn't know what to expect. And the way it got started off with all that dead time, you know, that was kind of a downer. Because, you know, we're used to every session we worked, 3 and 4 songs, you know. I mean, that's the way we did it in Nashville back in those days. And this was unheard of, to be paid and sit and do nothing. And we understood. He said he hadn't finished writing the song. We thought, okay, an hour or two, but 4 a.m. the next morning, you know, that was weird.
Al Kooper remembers the waiting game being lightened by Wayne Moss's dry wit.
We were taking a break about 4:30 in the morning, and we were in the control room. We weren't out there playing. It was very quiet. Nobody was saying anything. Everybody was like really tired anyway. Wayne said, you know, that hour of sleep I got last night is getting mighty lonely. Stuff like that was good. That Nashville sense of humor.
Oh, sad eyed lady, should I wait?
With Dylan still working on the first song to be recorded, the musicians entertained themselves with cards, board games, and the aforementioned ping pong. When Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands came to be cut in the early hours of the following morning, a further surprise lay in store for the assembled musicians.
About midnight or 1 o'clock, Dylan came in. He said, man, I got a thing here. I don't know, is anybody here? I said, yeah, I got everybody here. What are you going to do, go to sleep on Bob Dylan's thing? Are you kidding me? He said, well, see how many people you can round up. And I went and woke everybody up, and they all got all ready and came upstairs. So they came up and got ready, and Dylan said, well, this thing goes CDG, I think it is. And they said, well, where's charts? I said, you don't have any charts. So we don't have any charts. I said, no. And he started in playing. And so they all started playing, and they hooked this groove. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then broke down. When it broke down the first time, where he went back into the second verse, they thought that was the end of the record, because it was 2 minutes, 15, 20 seconds, and they got caught and jumped all in. And here they went again. And then down again, and he broke, and down again. 17 minutes later, he said, that's it. They came in, and he said, let's hear it back. We were off to Nirvana.
We probably ran it through twice, and then we recorded it twice. And that took a long time, because a 14-minute song, you know. You do it twice, you got a half hour gone. So I suppose it was 5:30 or 6 a.m. before we got out of there.
Oh, sad-eyed lady, should I wait?
Even the most experienced musician in the studio, pianist Pig Robbins, had never played on a session quite like this one.
As I remember, we just played whatever felt right to us, you know. I mean, working with his type music was totally different to me, because I'd, you know, just been used to a country or rockabilly or maybe some gospel or something like that. But we did short compared to his songs, you know. We did country records back then were probably 220, 230, 40. If you got 245 country record, that was a long song, you know. And we rolled in there with Bob, and some of those things run 7 or 8 minutes, you know, or I think somebody said one of them run 11 minutes or something. But anyway, it was totally something new to me.
For bassist Henry Strelecki, just listening back to the material they'd recorded was a departure from the norm.
I had never heard anybody play a track back as loud as they played it. I really honestly could go out in the hall, listen to the tracks and the cuts better than I could hear it in the control room because it was so loud. Make your ears bleed, you know?
Dylan's sad-eyed lady was revealed years later on the Desire album as his wife, Sarah. As Al Kooper observes, she too was in attendance at these historic recordings.
Sarah was there, which is not noted. She was rarely at the studio. She'd come pick him up, I think, or drop him off, one or the other. And you know, sometimes he'd say, "Oh, you got to hear this song," and he'd play her a song and like that. But her presence, you know, was there, which was rare.
For Al Kooper, both the camaraderie and musicianship of his new Nashville colleagues was striking.
I had never recorded outside of the New York area in my life. Of course, I was only 22, but I had started recording when I was 14. So that's like 8 years of just New York studios. And so this was interesting. I was a little apprehensive because I didn't know the musicians, but they were so nice and welcoming and that it never was difficult. We all got along instantly, and the camaraderie was quite nice. The playing, I never heard people play like that. They did things that the New York guys could never do. So it was eye-opening for me, especially since we weren't making country music per se. So I was just blown away.
The warmth noted by Al Kooper in the studio did not necessarily extend to other Nashville residents, as Cooper's visit to a famous local record store confirmed.
So that was on a day off. It was Ernest Tubbs' record store. I really wanted to go there because I was a, you know, record fan. I bought some stuff and I was walking back to the hotel. It was a bit of a walk to the hotel. Roger Miller's King of the Road Motel is where we were staying. And I got accosted by a gang of youngers, probably about 16, 17, but looking for trouble. And I guess I looked like trouble. My hair wasn't long yet. It still was short, but I had a leather jacket on, and I don't know. They came up to me, and I think they were going to, like, beat me up right on the street there. But this one guy, like, started to take a swing at me. And I, in an uppercut fashion, coming from my arm at its regular drop point, I hit him in the testicles. And he went down very hard. And I was in shock because I'm a lover, not a fighter. And I just started running. And I went into a bookstore because I figured they couldn't get me out of there. And fortunately, it was a payphone. Robbie, myself, and Bob had been put in the care of one of Elvis's bodyguards, Lamar Fike. And so he had his number. I called him. And I said, "How you doing, Al?" I said, "Not very good. I'm at such and such bookstore, and there's a gang outside that wants to beat me up." He said, "Okay," he said, "hold them off for about 5 minutes. I'll be right there." And they just waited outside. So they didn't come in the bookstore. Lamar pulled up about 5 minutes later. He had a big Cadillac, of course. And he might even have left it running. And walked in the store and he said, "Al, I can't leave you alone. You just get in trouble all the time. I wish you would stop beating people up." And he was saying this in front of the guys as we were walking. And we got in the car and we were laughing pretty hard. And he saved me.
Ain't it just tonight to play tricks when you're trying to be so quiet. We'll sit here stranded, though we're all doing our best to deny it.
Meanwhile, back in the studio, the Blonde on Blonde sessions continued to progress, drawing from a richly diverse musical palette that extended far beyond the folk and folk rock that Dylan had been associated with. The core group of musicians were joined by a young guitarist later to achieve fame in his own right.
Joe South played bass and guitar on stuff, and he played bass on Visions of Johanna, and he played guitar on Memphis Blues Again. And they both benefit tremendously by the way that he played. He had a style. But no one knew who he was at that time because he hadn't had his hits yet. So he was just a player, but he had great style.
Joe South, 3 years away from scoring a worldwide hit of his own with Games People Play, recalls his time with Dylan fondly and was influenced by watching him at work in the studio.
Oh, he was beautiful, man. He really was. I don't know, he was just a thrill, you know. I really loved watching him write, you know. I would stand around in the control room and it was dark. He would be in the back of the studio amongst a bunch of curtains and everything, and he would be writing the song. He would spend hours at it, man. Just hours. He sure had an effect on me because I would then spend hours.
In common with all involved, South remembers sessions characterized by their relaxed, good-humored nature with musical suggestions welcomed. His own improvised response to Dylan's early run-through of Just Like a Woman was included in the final arrangement, as he explains.
Nobody feels any pain. Tonight is lasting inside the rain.
Just like a woman. Yes, you do. That part there, you know. And as I look back on it, man, I thought he's going to think I'm a nut. But I couldn't help it. You know, that's the way rhythm and blues singers did every line they did. Oh, yes, it is. And yes, it was. And maybe it is. Like that. That's where he got that line. I'm sure it is. And I played the part on the gut string. Like that.
Queen Mary, she's my friend. Yes, I believe I go see her again.
Stylistically, Blonde on Blonde ranged from the fragile beauty of Just Like a Woman to the surreal take on R&B of Stuck Inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again. Al Cooper recalls Joe South's role on that particular track and remains surprised by his own contribution.
The ragman draws circles up and down the block. I'd ask him what the matter was, but I know that he don't talk. And the ladies treat me kindly, and they furnish me with tape. But deep inside my heart, I know I can't escape. Mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again.
He was very distinctive in his playing. And it worked great that he was the bass player on Visions of Johanna and really great on the guitar on Memphis Blues Again, because he and I were sort of trading off on Memphis Blues Again. I still can't believe when I hear that track that I was 22 years old when I played that. Because I don't think I could play it better now.
I'm Bill Nye, and you're listening to Nashville Cats, the making of Blonde on Blonde.
You know I just can't jump it. Sometimes it gets so hard, you see. I'm just sitting here beating on my trumpet with all these promises you left for me. But where are you tonight, sweet Marie?
The relative youth of all involved in the sessions is easily overlooked given the quality of musicianship on display. Drummer Kenny Buttrey was in his early 20s. Though he had been a professional musician since the age of 11, in Charlie McCoy's view, he was simply one of the finest musicians of his era, and the array of styles that Dylan was exploring suited him perfectly.
Kenny Buttrey is one of the best drummers I've ever worked with, and his roots were in R&B, you know, anything soul R&B, I mean, that was his cup of tea. He had to teach himself to be a country drummer, because that's not what he came from, you know. He came from rock and roll R&B. He was an exceptional talent. He could play all styles very well. The only thing I never heard him play was jazz, and I'm sure if he probably wanted to, he probably could have.
Fortunately, well, six white horses that you did promise were finally delivered down to the penitentiary. But to live outside the law, you must be honest. I know you always say that you agree. All right, so where are you tonight, sweet Marie? Well, I don't know how it happened, but the riverboat captain, he knows my fate. But it's gonna have to wait. Well, I got the fever down in my pocket. The Persian drunkard, he follows me. Yes, I can take him to your house, but I can't unlock it. You see, you forgot to leave the key. Ah, where are you tonight, sweet Marie?
Despite Dylan's hipper-than-hip status in 1966, the Nashville-based musician's wealth of experience meant that they were not awed by his reputation, a fact that undoubtedly contributed to the success of the sessions. Wayne Moss and Charlie McCoy.
I'd never heard of him except for, okay, you wrote Blowing in the Wind. Okay, great. But as far as being an icon in the music business, I didn't have a clue about that. I do now, but I didn't then. So it wasn't like anybody was uptight because it was Dylan. Because we didn't know who Dylan was. We do now, but we didn't then, so we were relaxed and said, well, this guy does folk songs. Okay, great. How's it go?
Most of us by that time had worked with lots of big, big stars. And we didn't consider stars up here and us down here. We considered us all on the same level because we all had to participate to make a record. So, you know, okay, he's a great singer, I'm a pretty good harp player, he's a great drummer, you know, and we collaborate and we make these records together. So we weren't awed by the star power. We respected what he had done, you know, because, I mean, he had already done quite a bit. but we weren't awed by it.
Producer Bob Johnston's unobtrusive approach was also key. Charlie McCoy.
He figured out right away that the musicians here are very creative, and you never close your mind to what they would suggest, because some of the best ideas come, you know, right on the spot. Anyone who works here, if they don't take advantage of that, they're crazy, because there's creative people here, really. He was smart that way. He knew when to step in and when to leave people alone.
Johnston was keenly aware of the Nashville players' capabilities and remembers the stark contrast with their New York studio counterparts.
You go in and you play in New York. You got a clock up in the middle, and the clock's running. And in the meantime, when you got a couple of minutes off, they go in and they're on the phone booking the next session that they're going to play in. And then they got to go to the bathroom. And then everybody comes back and forth and shit like that. And there's not any of that. The love of the music and the love of the artist and the faith in themselves and in their music and what they were doing captivated them. It captivated me to have Bob Dylan. I could have Bob Dylan in Switzerland. Have all the people in London down there at the London thing. No, man, I knew these guys and what they played, and I thought each one of them were brilliant, and they are.
Johnston's main concern was to give the artist and his colleagues on the session creative freedom. He was also intent on recording Dylan's every move in the studio, as both he and Wayne Moss recall.
I let those guys run, man, and they ran. They ran. Only thing I ever told journalists was that I let the tapes roll. I make sure I got plenty of machines there.
I remember that Bob Johnston had a two-track machine going all the time. Between cuts, anything that came out of Dylan's mouth got recorded. I don't care what it was. Separate and apart from the multi-track we were doing, you know. So they're in the archive somewhere.
The producer's decision to indulge Dylan's practice of completing lyrics in the studio was unwisely questioned by one Columbia employee, leading to an early, albeit minor, career break for an aspiring singer-songwriter. Wayne Moss again.
I think somebody was in the restroom, and the custodian there was in the next stall, and he was saying to himself, I don't understand why they put up with this, man. Why don't they get rid of that guy? And the stall adjacent to him was Bob Johnston. And he opened up the door and said, because his last record sold 1 million copies, is that okay? I think that's the day that the custodian got fired. And take guess who got his job. Chris Christopherson. So he was emptying ashtrays on the Dylan session.
For session dates that featured no written charts, it's notable that most of the tracks required no more than 2 or 3 takes. Dylan's creativity at this point was surfing a wave of inspiration that he himself marveled at years later. Though he did not arrive at his beguiling song poems without graft, as Al Cooper describes.
I don't think there was any improvising by Bob. There were days where he would come in and he said, I need to finish the lyric. And I'd go, okay. And so we'd all take a break, and he'd sit in the studio at the piano and finish the lyric in quotes. Sometimes it would take an hour. Sometimes it would take 6 or 7 hours. And he would just sit there and work. I mean, discipline beyond belief.
Alongside Robbie Robertson, Al Cooper was the closest musician to Dylan on the Blonde on Blonde sessions, and by early 66 had accrued considerable experience of playing alongside him. Despite this, he did not quite share the nonchalance of his Nashville colleagues, and on one occasion was fleetingly but acutely aware of the potential longevity of what he was involved in.
I already knew from Highway 61 what an impression he was making in this time period. As I played on that, and you could already tell that was going to be an album that was going to be around for a while. So there was a moment where we took a break during the session, and I was thinking to myself, you know, wherever you put your fingers is going to be like something that's going to last forever. People are going to listen to this forever. And you should be careful about where you put those fingers. And I stopped myself and I said, ugh, I can't think like that. I have to just play like I'm playing. And that's because that's what I did last time, and that's what I should do, and not have stupid thoughts like that. So, but it did happen once for about 30 seconds.
The luxury of taking breaks on a session was new for Henry Strelecki.
We'd take a break, and I wasn't used to that. I didn't know what was going on, man. You know, here we are sitting around getting paid for these recording sessions, and this had never happened in the country field, because you go in the country field and you got to get 3 or 4 songs in that 3 hours, you know, or else. Then on the gospel sessions, you had to get 6, because they didn't make as much money, you know, as the country artists did. And we would sit there and we would, might do one in that 3 hour period with Bob. And then we'd wait on him to finish writing the next song, and we'd come up and he'd play it for us, and we'd jump it there and start playing with him on it. And that's basically the way it really happened, as far as I can see.
Dylan's interaction with the other musicians on the sessions is remembered by most as minimal, and may partly be explained by his innate shyness. Al Cooper, however, recalls one occasion when there was a different reason behind his unwillingness to communicate directly with pianist Pig Robbins.
He said to me once, tell the piano player not to play in the intro, which is very rare that he would say something like this. So I said, why don't you tell him? I said, I think he would love to get that from you. And he said, oh, I can't call that guy Pig.
Even allowing for studio breaks for Dylan to finalize lyrics, the session soon began to proceed at a quicker pace, and the entire album was captured in one block of recordings. Some accounts have suggested that Dylan returned to Nashville for a second round of studio dates, though this misconception is due to an incorrect reading of the archived session sheets, as Al Cooper points out.
If someone records a session, it's noted on a session sheet. They say the names of the songs that were recorded and what day they were recorded. And if, like, 2 weeks later, somebody orders an acetate or a tape copy of that song to listen to, then a session sheet is filed, and you don't know what happened on that day. It just says, Visions of Johanna, 3 o'clock. Somebody went in and cut a tape copy of it for an executive, and they think it was a recording session, because they don't understand that about session sheets, Columbia Records session sheets. I'm really not familiar with any other record company session sheets like I am with Columbia. And so I'd have people say to me that were writing books about this, the second bunch of sessions, which took place so-and-so like this, and go, there was no second bunch of sessions. It was all done in, you know, 10 days or something like that.
A further point of controversy surrounds the recording of Rainy Day Women 12 and 35, the album's opening cut, and one of 5 tracks released as a single. Various sources have claimed that the track's intoxicating party atmosphere was fueled by a potent combination of green cocktails and marijuana. Participating musicians have even recalled the riotous studio recording in vivid detail.
Well, they'll stone you when you're trying to be so good. They'll stone you just like they said they would.
Wayne Moss.
Now, he told us, he said, now, this on this everybody must get stoned thing. I want everybody to hoop and holler and carry on like you're drunk, having a good time. And in order to ensure that, I told the custodian to go over to Ireland's restaurant and said, what's the strongest drink you've got in here? And he said, it's a leprechaun, it's in a shot glass. He said, give me 8 milkshake cartons full of that. He came back and he sat down and said, all right, boys, everybody drink this, and then we'll cut everybody must get stoned. So we did, and we were in various stages of being out of it and forgot to sign the time card.
Charlie McCoy, though, is convinced that the connection with leprechauns relates to another Nashville studio date and a singer-songwriter contemporary.
There is a connection with Bob Johnson and leprechauns, but it's not with Dylan, it's with Leonard Cohen. The incident he's talking about happened on a Leonard Cohen session. In fact, Bob Johnson took us all out on a break, and he said, I want to buy you guys a drink. And we never drank on sessions. And I said, Bob. He said, no, it's okay. I'm the producer. I'm saying it's okay. We went out, and I didn't drink leprechauns. I had a beer, probably. Anyway, we came back after an hour and a half, and Cohen wanted us to sing, and we couldn't stop laughing, and he fired us all right on the spot. So that's the leprechaun story. No, there was no drinking on a Dylan session.
Al Cooper concurs with Charlie McCoy's more sober recollection.
And there's a lot of stories about everyone being high or drunk for that. That's all bollocks. If it was truly drunken, it would not have been played very well. And that's what these guys were into. They were into professionalism. There was no alcohol. There was no marijuana. There was nothing like that. There was just professionalism.
What everyone agrees on is that there was much instrument swapping and a great deal of laughter.
Bob Johnson told us, he said, hey, he wants you to whoop it up, you know. It's like a party. Act like you're having a big time. And every time I hear that record, I can hear Henry, specifically Henry shouting in the background.
There's one place in it where I made some kind of hillbilly hee-haw thing or something, and it cracked Dylan up. And so he was singing along, and he kind of got tickled, and he kept going. But it's in there if you want to listen for it.
On hearing Dylan's early sketch of the track, producer Bob Johnston had suggested that it had a Salvation Army feel, leading to a late-night phone call from Charlie McCoy in search of brass.
Johnston's come to me, and he said, later today, we're going to record a song. We want a Salvation Army sound. So we need a trumpet and a trombone. And I said, you want it to be good, trumpet and trombone? He said, no. And I said, okay, I can do the trumpet. I can get a guy to come and play trombone. He said, okay, call him. I said, what time you want him? He said, midnight. Okay, so I called Wayne Butler. Come in at midnight.
With Wayne Butler's fruity trombone riding atop Hillbilly Hollering, and drummer Kenny Buttrey's marching drum pattern, Blonde on Blonde opened with a blend of old-time revivalism and a counterculture call to arms. The tracks that followed across the album's four sides mixed aching ballads with high-octane rock and roll and piercing R&B. One of the final tracks to be recorded was I Want You, Al Cooper's favourite at the time of the songs in progress. He remains convinced that Dylan saved it till last purposely.
Size, the lonesome organ grinder cries. The silver saxophones say I should refuse you. The cracked bells and washed out horns blow into my face with scorn. But it's not that way, I wasn't born to lose you. I want you. I want you. I want you so bad. Honey, I want you.
I pass the sleep, they wait for you. And I wait for them to interrupt me drinking from my broken cup and ask me to open up the gigs for you. I want you. I want you. Yes, I want you.
As I say to him every day, what song do you want to do tomorrow? You know, when we were leaving from the night before. And I'd always say, I want you. And he'd say, no, let's do like this. So I think that was the last song we recorded.
Both Al Kooper and Joe South share admiration for the ease with which guitarist Wayne Moss conjured up its deliriously infectious guitar line.
You know, the figure is and the guitar player went which is like 16th notes, which I had rarely heard a guitar player in the studio play in New York. He was just rolling it off. So I went, oh, that's unbelievable. It was Wayne Moss. I said, Wayne, can you play that every time it comes to that part? He said, sure. And I went, I can't, to myself. I can't play it any time. It was just amazing.
Oh, man, that swayed me. It was kind of like Merle Travis and sort of like Chet Atkins, too. But, man, it was great.
Wayne Moss himself is typically modest, though grateful for the freedom afforded him by Dylan's relaxed studio manner.
Al Kooper about came unglued when I went do-do-do-do-do-do. But it was just some licks I'd stole from Chet and stuff, so I didn't figure it was any big deal. They didn't say they wanted anything. They just said, whatever you all think. No suggestions, just whatever you feel like is appropriate. And we were in hog heaven. We were used to doing four songs a session. And we could relax all we wanted to, take all the breaks we wanted to. You know, there was no pressure. The only pressure was trying to stay awake long enough for Dylan to get his ducks in a row. And that was rather expensive on Columbia Records, but it was very, very nice on our house payments and stuff. So we were okay with it.
With the album completed, Bob Johnston was left to mix the LP alone. But Johnston himself is keen to deflect any praise for the record's sound and emphasizes Dylan's creative control.
I remember I used to take acetate. I'd do the mixing and then take acetate to Dylan. And then he'd listen and make notes of what he'd like. If you came up with a bass here and this thing, or if you did this. And I'd go back and do it. We didn't have automation then, so I used the cameras. And I took where the settings were with a film camera and filmed all the settings were with everything like that, so I could go back to that song and go find out where it was exactly and do what he wanted to do. If he wanted a bass note brought up, I'd bring it up. I thought he knew more than I do, or he wouldn't be there. I wouldn't. He'd be producing me.
One of the privileged few to hear the pre-release acetates of the album was journalist Jules Siegel, then profiling Dylan on tour for the Saturday Evening Post. As he explains, Dylan's excited expectation of playing the newly delivered discs was hampered by a minor technical difficulty.
They didn't have a portable record player, and so the hotel sends one up, and it doesn't have the spindle. It's just this little, you know, I don't know what kind of piece of garbage. I don't know where how they dug it up. And so Dylan practically started crying. And so Grossman motioned them away from the record player. And then he very carefully, by eye, positioned the LP over the spindle pole, and he played it. And it was great. And so he just was exalted there. And I was too. It was really great. It was just sensational.
The album, a double, was housed in a gatefold sleeve featuring a blurry cover shot of its star. Like much surrounding Dylan at the time, it was pored over by fans and critics alike and analyzed for symbolic significance. Photographer Jerry Schatzberg remembers being commissioned by Albert Grossman.
He called me and asked me if I was interested in doing a cover. And I said, oh yeah, absolutely. The first images that we did were actually done in the studio. Some of them very nice, I like a lot, I use them. But then I wanted to go out. And I always liked the meatpacking district when it wasn't Sheik in Chelsea and art galleries and all that. It was really a meatpacking district. And I asked them if that was okay with them. And yeah. And we went there. And I don't know if it was anybody but he and myself and my assistant, just the three of us, who were shooting. It was really quite cool. He had on a little jacket, a little suede jacket. I wasn't dressed too much, and it was a tough shoot. And I felt I was putting on him, you know. I was rushing through it a little bit. But he was really very cooperative. And when we got the pictures, there were some that were slightly out of focus, slightly blurred. And to his credit, that's what he chose.
Both Schatzberg and Dylan were aware of the Dylanologists' reading of the shimmery shot as acid symbolism and shared a wry amusement at the more prosaic reality.
I read all that. We talked about it, we laughed about it. We were both cold, we were shaking, whatever it was, and that's the result of it.
In an often quoted interview with Playboy, published in 1978, Bob Dylan claimed that the tracks released on Blonde on Blonde were the nearest he came to realizing the sound he heard in his head. It's that thin, that wild mercury sound, he enigmatically told journalist Ron Rosenbaum. Al Cooper had little idea then or now what he meant.
I don't think there was anything wild about those sessions. Perhaps Mercurial. It's my favorite album, and really not because I played on it. I don't mind hearing that at any point, even though I've heard it zillions of times. It's great to hear it again.
Blonde on Blonde closed Dylan's mid-60s electric period and raised the bar for his contemporaries in terms of what could be achieved on a rock album. The experience of working in Nashville had changed Dylan's music, and his decision to record there changed Nashville irrevocably. The narrow-minded music industry view of Nashville as a country music factory shifted in the wake of Blonde on Blonde, and it soon became the fashionable recording venue of choice. Charlie McCoy.
When he came, it was a different kind of artist who came here, because he was followed immediately by Joan Baez, Buffy St. Marie, Manhattan Transfer, Peter, Paul and Mary, Dan Fogelberg, Leonard Cohen, Gino Vanelli. It was amazing. Up until then, this had been mainly a country music recording center. After that, it was like everything.
Whilst Dylan's creative zenith is widely acknowledged, the contribution of the Nashville musicians has perhaps been underappreciated, despite Dylan's insistence, unheard of at the time, that they receive sleeve credits. Wayne Moss.
The best thing I can say about Dylan is that he started a trend that's going to this day, and that's putting album credits on the album so people will know who played that lick. That was never done before in Nashville. You could have hit records all you wanted, but you didn't know who played on them. It said what studio it was cut at, and the engineer might have been so-and-so or the arranger. But they wouldn't tell you Wayne Moss or Charlie McCoy or anybody like that. Dylan started that, and it kind of shamed the rest of the record companies into saying, okay, we'll put you on there. At that point, our amount of sessions went way up, because it's like, man, I want the guy that played on. I want you.
As Henry Strelecki recalls, he had no doubt that the album would be a success thanks to an unlikely intervention from the spirit world.
I knew something was really different about it because Pig's wife, Vicky, brought a Ouija board in. So while we were sitting around waiting on Bob to finish the song or get ready to play it for us, we'd be down there playing with that Ouija board. And I remember saying, Vicky, ask it, is this going to be a hit session? Or are we going to get a hit record out of this? And of course, it went over. It said yes. And everything we asked that Ouija board about the sessions, it was all positive. So it had to be. The karma was with us. I've never since done a session like those. I really thought they were special.
The Ouija board prognostications were entirely accurate. Blonde on Blonde was released 45 years ago today, on May the 16th, 1966, and was an immediate critical and commercial success, going on to achieve double platinum sales. It was also rock's first double album, narrowly beating the Mothers of Invention's Freak Out into the record racks by a week. The following November, after his recovery from a motorcycle crash, Dylan returned to Nashville, where he cut the Old Testament-influenced John Wesley Harding and its country-hued follow-up, Nashville Skyline. Blonde on Blonde may have been Dylan's crowning achievement and was primarily the result of his singular vision. But as Charlie McCoy concludes, it would not have been possible anywhere other than Nashville.
I don't think he could have done that record in any other recording center the way he did it here. Hey, the three albums he did here, I think that was the peak of his career. The only thing that disappointed me was that he quit coming.
Is this really the end? To be stuck here inside a mobile with the Memphis blues again.
Nashville Cats, The Making of Blonde on Blonde, was a BBC Six music production for Radio 2, written and produced by Henry Lopez Real.
And